Nafees Mossadeq Ahmed is the author of several important books, the most recent being The London Bombing, is an independent inquiry. On this program, you heard him discuss two earlier works, The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked, September 11, 2001, and The War on Truth, 9/11 Disinformation and the Anatomy of Terrorism, which dealt with a largely hidden political background to those attacks. That book got him invited to testify as an expert witness before the U.S. Congress. His second book, Behind the War on Terror, Western Secret Strategy and the Struggle for Iraq, examined the role of energy in the pattern of Western interventionism in the Middle East since the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. He currently teaches at the Department of International Relations, University of Sussex in Brighton, where he is a PhD candidate, researching the relationship between European imperialism since the 15th century and Western practices of violence and genocide. He is, in addition, director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in central London. Welcome, Nafees Ahmed. Glad to have you back with us.
Hi, Jeff. Good to be here again.
For those who question the official U.S. government narrative about the events of 9/11 with its gaping holes, the arrest last month of 24 young British Muslims charged with planning to blow up a dozen civilian airliners, it brought a sense of deja vu that once again the public was being treated to smokes and mirrors. How accurate is that assessment?
It's very accurate, Jeff. Unfortunately, we're seeing a concerted strategy by the United States and Britain to basically ratchet up this specter of a terrorist threat in order to justify a whole host of domestic and international programs of repression. And I think what we're seeing is very, very worrying because it's not just an isolated phenomenon. It's happening across the world. We have escalating terror raids, not just by Britain and by the United States, but by a number of European countries, all of them claiming to have found evidence of homegrown networks which are attempting to carry out terrorist attacks. Now, in all of these cases, you find the same pattern, and I scrutinized quite closely the narrative of the August terror plot, and with a little bit of scrutiny it fell apart. And one of the interesting things that happened was the New York Times published an expose of a kind of an inadvertent expose. I mean, they weren't actually trying to deconstruct the plot very much, but much of what they reported about a week ago, I think, was completely undermined everything that both the US and British officials were saying about the plot. It confirmed that, and corroborated other reports that I found in the public record. It confirmed that there wasn't any imminent plot, and that was from British security officials. And officials also confirmed that the people involved were basically underwent torture. People who were detained in Pakistan were tortured by the Pakistani security services, and therefore the information that they were giving is clearly fundamentally questionable. And many, many other elements of the plot just fell apart. So I think what we're seeing is very, very worrying, and this is the sign of things to come. It's not something that we're only going to see. We've seen the end of it, and now we'll move on to other things. This is something that is the start of a pattern that is very of a lot of concern.
Well, the timing was very interesting because Bush and Blair both see falling poll numbers and unpopularity with the U.S. and the British war in Iraq, what's going on in Afghanistan, and they needed something to bring their public around, or at least try to do it, to make the American public and the British public think there is actually something going on that requires U.S. and British policy being what it is. And obviously, even the British admitted there was nothing imminent about it. Even if the accusations were correct, there was no imminent attack planned.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the interesting thing. We have five British security officials telling newspapers separately and telling the New York Times as well that there wasn't any imminent plot. And in fact, the timing is very interesting because a number of American and British officials have said that there was disagreement over timing. The British were basically saying that, look, we've been monitoring these guys already for a year, but we see no evidence of an imminent plot. We see no reason to take any action right now. And in fact, they didn't want to move to do the arrest. There was one report, and this was corroborated by the New York Times, which said quite clearly that the British did not want to arrest Rashid Rauf. And Rashid Rauf is the British national currently in Pakistan. Warren in detention, who is being described as the key informant and he's being described as the main Al Qaeda go-between. But the Pakistani Human Rights Commission has confirmed that he has been tortured under interrogation. So this really does raise fundamental questions about what we're being told, because a number of us have also said that the impetus to move came not from the British, but from somebody in the American administration. And they pressured the British government, which pressured our security services to move. So there was actually a serious conflict going on here about what was to be done. And I think there's no doubt that in view of this was a clearly politically motivated alert that was timed politically. It was timed in relation to the escalating crisis and debacle in the Middle East. I think there can be no doubt about that, given the fact that there was no objective reason to move at this time. So this is what we're seeing. We're seeing here clearly that terrorism is being used as a political tool to justify much more familiar objectives of social control.
Well, one other aspect might have been there was something else happening besides Iraq and Afghanistan at the time the news was released, and that was Israel's assault on Lebanon in the name of fighting terror. So perhaps the neocon influence in Washington was what pushed that decision to have the British make those arrests at this time.
I think that's plausible. I think the Lebanon equation is without a doubt absolutely integral to understanding what happened. I mean, we have to look at if you look at this in simple terms, I mean, the British government raised the alert level to its highest level, critical, which basically means that there is the threat of an imminent strike. But we now have multiple British officials and American officials confirming that there was no imminent strike being. There was no imminent plan. I mean, these guys didn't have airline tickets. They didn't even have passports. So even if they were extremists, or even if they had perhaps some sort of plan, which we haven't actually seen any evidence of, but even if that is the case, the raising of the alert level to which was supposed to be based on it's supposed to be an intelligence-driven decision, was not driven by intelligence. It was driven by a political decision. It had nothing to do with any real threat. So, in other words, this is a very, very clear, documented example of how our governments are using fear and using terrorism to instill fear into the population in order to kind of legitimize and to draw attention away from things that are going on elsewhere. And at that time, Lebanon was happening. Lebanon was clearly in the news everywhere, and people were looking at Israel quite critically and wondering why on earth they were still in Lebanon bombing the hell out of, you know, hundreds and thousands of civilians. So I think this is very, very important.
Now, there are obviously elements in Britain, including Minister Reid, but also in the police, who have made statements that this was just the tip of the iceberg, and that there are potentially thousands of British Muslims who are potentially terrorists or supporters of terrorism in England. This is creating, obviously, an atmosphere of the British racism that has always been there against Muslim immigrants and other immigrants.
Yeah, this is very interesting. I mean, this is a very important line of analysis, Jeff, because what is happening now is that I really feel that a number of strategic and economic imperatives, as well as the influence of powerful lobbies and ideologies, are pushing forward, they're converging and pushing forward for a very, very concerted Middle East assault that could end up on using Israel to reconfigure the region. And Iran, a potential conflict in Iran, is a very, very key issue. I think that the plans for that are there, there's no doubt, and I think the neocons really do want that. It's a case of whether they can make it happen. One of the things I think that is happening here is that they're using this completely fabricated narrative of a terror threat, essentially to whip up anti-Muslim sentiment around the world, and Britain is specifically playing the key propaganda role. What is happening in Britain is being publicized around the world. It's being mirrored in terror raids by different countries who are following Britain's example, and in this way they're generating more and more hostility within communities around the world against Muslims. Muslims are the threat. Muslims are, any Muslim could be a terrorist. It could be a normal guy who works, who, you know, you see him every day, he's smiling, happy, he goes on holiday. Any person can be targeted if he's could be seen as a potential threat if he's a Muslim. This is the kind of impression that they're trying to give, and it's something that is of a lot of concern. And specifically this claim about several thousand potential British citizens who could be terrorists. Well, this is interesting, because after 9/11, there's a group, which I wrote about in my book, called Al-Muhajirun, which is currently still active in the UK. It operates under different names. And its leader is a man called Omar Bakri Muhammad. Now, Omar Bakri Muhammad was actually among a number of other extremist Muslim clerics in this country. He was recruited by MI6 in the mid-90s, and one of the specific reasons he was to get British Muslims to go and fight in Kosovo. And as your listeners are probably aware, Kosovo was another... that we had a number of covert operations going on there alongside the KLA in order to destabilize that country. And the game plan that we had there was very much, it wasn't the only thing, but was very much linked to plans to establish the Trans-Balkan oil pipeline, oil and gas pipelines, which would cross the Balkans. And one of the things that's interesting is that Omar Bakri, who has been here in this country for many, many years, more than a decade, has been basically recruiting a number of people, and Muslims and non-Muslims alike have been shouting at the police saying, why don't you arrest this guy, because he's clearly an extremist, he advocates killing of civilians, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we now know that this guy was actually working for our intelligence services, and this actually came from John Loftus, who used to be in the Justice Department. He gave an interview in Fox News last year where he confirmed this, and it's subsequently been confirmed by several other intelligence sources. The French and the Americans have said the same thing. Now, what is interesting is that after 9/11, this guy organized approximately several hundred British Muslims to go from Britain to Pakistan to Afghanistan to basically train there and come back inside the UK. I remember actually reading the papers at the time, and I was reading papers like The Telegraph, The Evening Standard, The Times, and I was reading that they were actually interviewing some of the Al-Muhajirun activists who were working with Omar Bakri, who were openly saying that when we come back, we're quite happy to consider we think that Britain should be a target of terrorist attacks because of what it's been doing around the world. And when we come back, we will consider doing that. And this is shocking to me, because I just thought, well, these guys have got this huge apparatus of anti-terrorism legislation, which they're saying that they need. And why aren't they doing anything about these guys who happen to be linked to MI6 and MI5, who are coming in and out of Britain and openly saying that, well, actually, we want to come and carry out a terrorist attack? So now, when we listen to Peter Clark saying that, oh, well, there's thousands of British Muslims out there who are willing to carry out terrorist attacks, I think it's instructive to take into account precisely what the intelligence services and the government were doing in relation to a group which we know has been at least saying openly that they advocate terrorist activities. And why were they linking up with them and allowing them to be active for so long?
Well, this takes us back to some of what you have written about 9/11, the very strange reaction or failure to react on the part of U.S. and British intelligence against people who would appear to be serious threats. And also, you've written about the connection in both cases to the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, which has been much involved in all of this.
Absolutely, and the ISI is still very much involved. One of the interesting things that I found out when I was researching the terror plot, the August terror, this group of suspects that had been detained, and the network that they're apparently associated with, a number of reports from Pakistan confirmed that the ISI had actually penetrated this group quite thoroughly. And one source in the Pakistani intelligence service actually said that there were agent provocateurs inside this group. And apparently this group was actually, members of this group were associated with Al-Muhajirun, Omar Bakri, which again raises the specter of British intelligence quite directly. But this Pakistani source said that there were Asian provocateurs from the Pakistani ISI inside this group who probably encouraged them and pushed them along and basically entrapped them into getting involved in this thing. And this obviously raises fundamental questions about our relationships with the Pakistani ISI, because we know very well that Pakistan was involved in the financing of 9/11. Ahmed Omar Sheikh Saeed, who is currently languishing in a Pakistani prison for the murder of Daniel Pearl, he still hasn't been tried and sentenced properly for that murder, which he's been accused of. His trial keeps getting delayed repeatedly, and what we're not being told is that although his link to the Daniel Pearl murder has been widely publicized, his link to 9/11 hasn't. Even though it's very well documented, we know that the FBI and Pakistani and Indian intelligence sources, all of them confirm that Ahmed Omar Sheikh Saeed wired several hundred thousand dollars to the chief alleged hijacker, Mohammed Atta, prior to 9/11, and that he did this on the order of Mahmoud Ahmed, who at that time was Director General of the ISI. And this is very well documented. So the fact that we are still using Pakistan in supposed counter-terrorism exercises obviously reveals that what we're seeing here is not counter-terrorism at all. It's the political use of terrorism in order to pursue wider strategic objectives.
Well, that brings up another point in an article you recently wrote about this issue, about a little-known operation that was approved in August 2002, where there was a report in the Pentagon by something called the Proactive Preemptive Operations Group, or PTOG, which was revealed in this report you write by the Pentagon's Defense Science Board. And this is what's happening today seems to be in line with what was in that article.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the most disturbing thing, that, I mean, before 9/11, we don't have, I mean, there are some documentation available hinting at this kind of policy, but, I mean, this, what we have here, the Defense Science Board was basically advising the Pentagon that you should activate this strategy, which essentially said we should stimulate reaction amongst terrorist networks so that they start activating, they start carrying out operations, presumably carrying out attacks. And once they do that, the idea is that they'll be more vulnerable to being targeted. This is the rationale. But what is the important thing is that in the intermediate phase is this idea of stimulating reactions. I mean, in practice, how are we going to do that? You would have to infiltrate the terrorist group. You would have to have agents in there who would be directing the operation, trying to encourage the groups to actually carry out operations, to carry out terrorism, in order for them to actually do that. So this really does start to get us closer to the idea that there is an active tendency amongst policymakers in the West at this time to encourage terrorist attacks as part of a strategy, supposedly, of fighting terrorism. I mean, obviously, this brings into question the very notion that there is a genuine war on terror. And one of the interesting things is that there was an article by Seymour Hersh that I mentioned in The New Yorker, where he was talking about an impending nuclear war with Iran. And one of the things, in a couple of paragraphs, he mentioned that there was this strategy that he'd been told by a number of officials in the Pentagon that had this strategy that was active of actually getting together with terrorist groups, recruiting locals, getting them to get involved in combat operations and so on and so forth as a part of the strategy, which indicated to me that P2OG, that was the name given to this category of operations, was basically active. It's now been activated for sure. And this really does explain why Congress is being kept in the dark about the millions
this such operations wouldn't be entirely new historically. We've had governments in the past create anti-government organizations which recruit their members based on legitimate grievances against the government. And then they use them, they put agents provocateurs in these organizations to cause them to take actions which will then justify further government crackdown on civil liberties, for example, or laws in Britain that restrict personal freedoms.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key things of my research is looking at the fact that so many of these individuals who are described as senior al-Qaeda operatives are in fact working for the intelligence services. And this is extremely well documented in both The War on Truth and my book, The London Bombings. I document a consistent pattern whereby senior al-Qaeda operatives have been recruited as informants or more by different intelligence services. And in Britain, this is a very serious problem. Almost every single radical at play that we now have behind bars was actually working for the intelligence services. One guy, Abu Qatada, who was described as al-Qaeda's European ambassador, we don't know if that was true, but that's how the British government described him. He was actually, the French have been saying that they were after him for years for links to terrorist operations in North Africa and elsewhere. And they said that this guy was actually being protected by the British. He was an MI5 double agent. And that was why it took so long to get him behind bars. The same thing applied to Abu Hamza. He was regularly in contact with MI5. And he had through a number of intermediaries as well as directly. And again, I mentioned Omar Barkhi. And Omar Barkhi is a very interesting example because a year before the London bombings, he actually gave an interview in a Portuguese newspaper where he said that I know that there is going to be an imminent attack on London. And I'm familiar with the groups that are involved, al-Qaeda groups within London, he said, which clearly indicated that this guy was in the know, he had some kind of connection to these groups. So you would think that this would be the first person you would want to investigate in relation to the 7/7 attacks. But instead of doing that, the British government said, well, look, he's an extremist. We don't want him in this country. So when Omar Barkhi went out of the country to Lebanon to visit his family there, the British government decided that they wouldn't allow him back in the country, which was hailed as a triumph in the British media here. But in fact, what it meant was that Omar Barkhi was now outside of British jurisdiction and effectively protected from investigation and prosecution by the British police. Currently, Omar Barkhi is still operating. I have sources who have told me that they've been monitoring him, his communications with people inside the UK now, and he's quite freely talking to them over the internet and telling them what to do and giving them ideas and preaching. So I think this issue of protection of terrorist networks is absolutely crucial, and it's important that we understand how far up this goes. I just want to point out one final thing before I let you continue, Jeff, which is the status of Ayman al-Zawahiri. And Ayman al-Zawahiri is described as al-Qaeda's deputy commander. He's bin Laden's right-hand man. He was spliced in with the videos on the London bombings where we have Mohammed Sadiq Khan and Shahzad Tanweer talking on the videotapes. So this is a very significant guy. And Yusuf Badansky, who used to be the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism, wrote a couple of years back in a strategic policy journal. He said that in 1997, Ayman al-Zawahiri was actually approached by the CIA and offered $50 million if he would basically protect... I've got a bit of noise in the background. If he would protect U.S. interests in the Balkans. And subsequently, we have seen that has actually happened, and Budansky points that out, that this does actually seem to be happening. So this really raises fundamental questions. If you have someone as senior as al-Zawahiri being recruited by the CIA, I don't think we can view al-Qaeda in the conventional sense anymore.
Well, I agree with that. Also, in that same light, the information supposedly about the use of liquids mixed on the plane to bomb a number of airliners came from this Raoul Raouf, who is in Pakistan, and the British have no intention of extraditing him, or does the United States. He's going to stay in Pakistan. This is the source of the story. Is that correct?
That's true. I mean, most of the information, I mean, it's very unclear precisely where this information came from. We know that Rashid Ralph was one of the key sources. We also know, as you said, that there is no intention of extraditing him. The British kind of muddled about it and said, well, you know, it's going to be take a long time. We're trying to do it, but it'll take a while. Whereas the Pakistanis were a little bit more open. They just said, well, there's no chance. He's not going to be extradited without any explanation. And clearly, if this guy is the bigwig that they say he is, you would expect that he would be the first person they'd want to bring here and put to trial. And in fact, British intelligence officials who were involved in the surveillance of this group, they said they didn't want to arrest Rashid Ralph, but they said that when they were told they had to, they said that they wanted to do it with due process, and they wanted to try him in a British court of law. They didn't want to do it otherwise. But the intelligence services were manipulated and overrided by some higher-ups who said, no, we have to move, and the Pakistanis moved and did it. And it's another thing that you'll be interested to know is that the whole liquid explosives thing is really just absolutely absurd from the perspective of chemical science. It doesn't make any sense. And we're actually going to be, I've been working with a couple of people here to put out a story. We've been trying to get the story in The Independent on Sunday, which I have a good relationship with, but I don't know if they're going to run it because it's very controversial. Very simply, and you heard it here first, Nigel Wild, who is he's a former British Army intelligence officer. He worked in Northern Ireland. He actually is an explosives expert because he defused hundreds and hundreds of bombs in Northern Ireland on hand. And this guy is considered basically a hero here. And he's basically saying, he's told me, that this whole idea that you could take these chemicals or household products on a plane and sit in the plane lavatory and create a liquid explosive is absolutely ridiculous. He goes, it's just not going to happen. You would have to distill the purity, distill the right chemicals in the right purities at freezing temperatures, and the process would take from 12 to 36 hours. It was also a very dangerous process in all likelihood. Even if you had a lab and you weren't in the plane like that, you'd probably still just blow yourself up rather than do anything else. And the whole thing would be detected very quickly because the process emits these vile fumes and a terrible smell which you could pick up within a radius of about 10, 20 meters or so. And it would, he said basically it would just be impossible to do. The worst thing that could most likely happen is you would end up killing yourself, but you wouldn't be able to take down the plane. So that's from someone who has worked at the highest levels in the British Army. And we're hopefully going to be coming out with that story very soon. But it shows very clearly that this story has absolutely no credibility whatsoever. And Nigel Wild says that this methodology would never have been invented by Al Qaeda, at least as conventionally defined, which is, you know, they would want to carry out a successful attack, not an attack which fails, which raises the question of who came up with this idea if it wasn't Al Qaeda.
When I was in Britain in July for a few days, was the number of cameras all over London photographing people on the street, photographing parking areas, driving areas. I've never seen a city more photographed in terms of people's lives going in and out of the metro, the underground, and so on. This was a startling revelation. People were wondering about photographs being taken of people going in and out of the subways, but you see these cameras everywhere in London.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting, speaking of the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, was one of the first people to take a position criticizing, questioning the whole arrest in August.
Absolutely. Oh. Absolutely. He was one of the most outspoken. One of the interesting things he brought up was the ricin plot, the infamous ricin plot over here, where police said that they found tubs of, you know, large plastic containers of this dangerous poison, ricin. In fact, what Craig Murray says is there's only two things you need to know about the ricin plot. The first thing is that there was no ricin, and the second thing is that there was no plot. And he's absolutely right. For years, the government government suppressed the fact that they had not actually found anything. And this really does make you question, when the government is saying that they found, you know, components, bombs, and this, that, have they really found that, or is it just another case of the Western kind of lie?
One thing that is really worrying, and obviously it's not just to me, in respect to the statement I mentioned earlier of the potentially thousands of British Muslims who were terrorists in England, the term Islamo-fascist has become the latest buzzword being used by the fascists of our day. And from the very first days after 9/11, Bush called his war on Al-Qaeda a crusade. And do British Muslims, in a sense, see themselves as victims of this crusade?
I think there's definitely a very strong sentiment here. And I think that sentiment is felt amongst Muslims all over the world. This sentiment that there is actually a very specific demonization of Muslims who are basically being made out that any Muslim could be a terrorist, and there's something intrinsically wrong with our faith, with the Islamic faith, which makes Muslims have this tendency towards, you know, violence and bigotry and other kinds of inhuman or less than human traits. And this is not actually a new phenomenon. I mean, the demonization of the other is something that is very integral to imperial policy, and it always has been since the 15th century, in fact. And it played out in different ways against different communities. We even saw it in various ways during the Cold War with the communists and the leftists and the Marxists and the socialists and people who weren't socialists, people who were just having uprisings and rebelling against repressive regimes and calling for economic independence. They're all lumped together in this way and otherized, made out to be this other, this enemy we need to be fearful of. And this is the same structure that we're seeing today. It's absolutely essential for this system to survive to project out there the perception of an enemy in order that it can continue to function, because the system is derived from, you know, exploitation of other resources, control of other populations, and so on and so forth. I mean, obviously, that's not the whole story, but it's part of the story. And that is why there is this need to always project this other. And today, looking at the conflict in the Middle East, it's Muslims who are the people who should be targeted for these very specific strategic reasons.
You do have a website, and I want people to be able to get in contact with you and be able to get a hold of your writings and your books. So if you give us that information, that would be great.
Yeah, I have a blog which I update every week or so, which is nafiz.blogspot.com. I'll say it again, nafiz.blogspot.com, and Nafiz is spelled N-A-F-E-E-Z. And I have my institute website is globalresearch.org, although that hasn't been updated for a long time and will probably be updated in the next few months, so you wouldn't bother checking that immediately. And apart from that, I do write a lot for Op-Ed News, so people can check that out too.
Well, just Google your name, Google Nafiz Ahmed, A-H-M-E-D, on the website, and you'll get a lot of informative material. Nafiz, I want to thank you for being our guest again on Takes on the World, and look forward to talking to you again and continuing your excellent researches.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on again. I look forward to